Hello and welcome to From Fear to Fire, secrets to overcome fear, embrace your gifts, and achieve success. This is the place where real people share real challenges and where you can find a common bond and uncommon wisdom through their journeys to help you move from fear to fire. I am Heather Hansen O'Neill, and I am your host as always. We've got a great quote for you to kick this off today. Great companies start because the founders want to change the world, not make a fast buck. And this is by Guy Kawasaki. We have such a cool guest for you today with amazing stories. So I want to get right to it. Gregory Ness is a B2B tech marketing leader of startups with over 20 years in Silicon Valley. Exits include IPO, billion and 100 million acquisitions, and key security acquisitions. Greg focuses on helping early companies reduce the amount of mistakes that are very common with tech startups. Greg, how are you?
Hey, Greg, great to be here. And we finally got to connect after a couple of years.
Okay, so we have to tell them the story. Are you okay with that, Greg?
Sure.
Okay, so I was supposed to interview Gregory Ness about 2 years ago, and he didn't show up. And I'm like, that doesn't seem like him. And then I found out why. How about you finish the story? You want to tell him what happened?
I had an aorta dissection in July 22nd. I think that was right around the time. Yeah. And I was in the hospital for about 3 or 4 weeks. And it was just a big surprise for me. Mm. And really, boom. And then wondering whether I was going to live or not, right? And through all that, and had a bunch of other issues for a while. Then started healing and coming back. And a few months later, went back to work gradually. And then now I'm back. So it took a while. It took a good solid year and a half.
Yeah. And you made some changes to help, though, didn't you? You made some changes in your life.
Absolutely. I mean, I always have enjoyed business and startups, especially. But there's a lot of stress. You know, you're working typically six days a week, long hours, pretty crazy time. And we all knew in Silicon Valley that 90% failure rate, and then the highly competitive to finish number one versus number two and number three. And that took a toll. And then, you know, to get back more family, more lifetime, doing other things after that, 20 plus years. In the last five, I was doing fractional consulting where I'd come in for like 4 hours or 8 hours a week to startups, not ask for equity and just keep it a nice hourly, and then work for different companies and kind of help them. And I've loved that. I've really enjoyed it. This was recommended to me from my last CEO at Vitter. When we were getting bought by another company, he says, this is what you belong. You should be doing two or three or four of these at one time. And nobody would ever know unless you had to be at the office. And I asked for him for permission to start it. And he goes, yeah, go ahead, let's do it. And then they got bought by Verizon, a company that I had worked for many years ago. So it was pretty funny. But anyway, so that's how I got there.
Wow. I mean, an amazing story. And I'm just so grateful that you're well now, you're back, you're rocking and rolling, and still finding that peace too, because that's important as well.
Absolutely.
Now, when I introduced you, I was talking about how in this role, these roles that you have with startups, you help them find the mistakes before they make them, right? So can you tell us a little bit more, like, are there common mistakes that you see when you're talking with a CEO?
So most of my first 10 of them, I was brought in after there was already a marketing VP.
Okay.
And it was typically somebody who was extremely smart and came from a large company. And so they had a formula that worked there. But then when it came into Startupville, and you had larger budgets and advertising, bigger money spent on numerous things from email, cold marketing, cold calling, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't working. Mm-hmm. And so I was brought in because the first one I did okay. And then I got into another one and we did well in another one. And so I had a good rotation. And by good, I mean surviving, right?
Yeah.
And being able to expand and raise more money and all of those things. Mm-hmm. And so I would come in and I would tell people, look, we haven't figured this out yet. I'm not bringing what worked at my last company. We're going to have to figure it out because every one of these is unique and different. And what we were going to do is we're going to spend as little money as possible, and we're going to study what is working and what isn't. And as things work, we're going to amp it up. And most of the execs that came through these startups and didn't last very long were basically doing what worked at these larger companies, larger budgets, you know, all this, but they weren't used to companies that had no credibility, no awareness, nothing coming from the get-go. Yeah. And that's hard to fix with like design or a lot of somebody calling you a lot or emailing you a lot, a company you've never heard of versus a company like an Apple or a Cisco or, you know, those type of things. And so I ran into that a lot, and I still run into it with CEOs that have run into somebody who worked at this great company and must know what they're doing in marketing. And then they bring them in for 6 months, 8 months, and then go, okay, this is a lot different than this great company I came from. And I've been at big companies too, so I know a little bit about where the differences are.
Wow. You know, and I really like the way that you said it, because startups and a lot of companies right now, with the way the world is changing, have to adapt quickly, right? To change. And the way that you were talking about finding out, you know, kind of what's working and then amp it up a little bit, right? So I think that's really important for people to take away, that you can't just go and do what we've always done, right? Like with these big companies, but that you're figuring it out along the way and making adjustments. I call it tracking and tweaking.
Absolutely. And then nobody, you know, in the, at least in the enterprise business, is waiting for that email or phone call from somebody about a new startup they've never heard of. Nobody is.
They're not sitting around waiting for you. Yeah.
And if they is, they're not a real person. Yeah. They don't have a budget.
I love it. I love it. So what are the differences today with tech startups as opposed to when you started over 20 years ago?
Well, way back when, you know, there was this crazy, well, there are a couple things. Number one, I was literally in my late 30s, early 40s when I entered Silicon Valley. And what really hit me early on was a lot of executives and VCs were saying, we need to hire somebody who's under 21 or under 22, because they're going to take a lot of risk and spend some big money and, you know, all of that. And I remember hearing that. And I, at that point in time, I had more than 10 years of experience in marketing. And I was like, boy, that's very interesting. What a risk, you know, craziness. And I have one of the companies I work for, it's not even on my resume. I was there for 3 months and it was a disaster. And I tried to stop it, but I couldn't. But it was along that theory. So in those days, it was about big money. You wanted to be number one company, because the number ones could be worth billions. And then number two and three are going to be like the 100 million, 10 million. And then after that, you're in the fire sale and you're going to be selling your furniture, you know, that kind of thing. And many of these were, you know, 5-10 different competitors all kind of hitting at once. Mm-hmm. But the good news was, is that especially around software networking, there was a huge innovation, and the business impact of these solutions were so big that people were very open to innovation at that particular time. There weren't that many startups yet. There might have been a few hundreds versus tens of thousands today. But in those days, the executives were actually fascinated. You could send an email, you could put out a newsletter, you could call, and they're like, oh my God, this is a new tech company, right? So that was, you know, from the 1990s into about, I would say around 2008, it worked pretty well, to where all of that email, cold calling, and, you know, content and the articles in the press, the amazing publications, all were very effective. Now, today, many of those print publications are gone. They're fragmented themselves. The amount of editors and analysts is a much smaller, but there's a lot more startups and people, you know, competing. I mean, there's thousands just in the security area, which is one of the hardest. And so the dynamic of credibility and awareness is far more important than it was 20 years ago. Very different in that way.
And you've been through it all. You've seen it, right? You've seen it all and all the changes. That's very exciting. Is there something that, from your experience through all of this, that would maybe be some qualities or something that would be ideal for a startup to have that you're like, oh, this could really work?
Well, early on, before I was in the Startupville and I was up in Seattle marketing and I was part of this advertising group, I met the very first marketer for Nike about tennis shoes. And he was saying, everybody's got tennis shoes. So I can't just go out with tennis shoes. So we have to be something different. So we're going to turn our customers into heroes, our athletes. And that's how we're going to differentiate. Okay. And then I saw, Apple do the same thing, right? Turning heroes. And so what I started doing early on and what continues to work today is establishing credibility by your customers and telling their story and making them the heroes. And so I've done some pretty wacky notions of that, including when one of our companies was bought, we turned into these little business cards, these little
How
gum
fun.
cards, you get baseball team, and we turned our customers into these heroes, and we put them in little packages, and at Network World we were passing them out,
Oh, I
and
love
people would come
it.
by, pick them up, and open to read about, guess what, our customers and what cool things they were doing. And then what did that do is it then a lot of other customers came in saying we'd like to be in that set too, and that dynamic kind of happened. And so at every startup I've kind of helped companies get that credibility in those case studies and do them in a way that aren't like an ad for a big company, but rather a story about the people who are accomplishing great things with them, so that in them there's very little like branding and name, which is what every one of my customer, my customer, my partners, they would want to like drop our name here, 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 here. It's like, no, it's all about them. And they will find us because we will mention ourselves a couple times, but it's all about them and their heroes. And it works because people want to hear about what their other people are doing to solve problems. They don't want to hear about speed and feed or something about specifically to the company. And that's often one of the mistakes that these startups would make, is even if they did the case studies, they were like a big ad, and sometimes they weren't even accurate. And so we vouch for accuracy 100%. There's no compromise. There's no, well, let's amp this up. And I had many arguments with executives over that process, but they finally, I would not do it any other way. So I would also point to that as well.
I love that. And we've spoken on other conversations about the importance of these case studies and the third party validation, but they're not always that easy to get, are they?
They can be quite difficult, and you have to become very innovative. To give you an example, a major company that was in the let's just say they were a drink company, drink brand, and their marketing executives that basically ran it, and they were a top brand, would not do case studies. No, they wouldn't. So what we did is we created it for their IT team. And we made it 100% accurate, and it made their team look amazing. We sent it up to the CIO, and he goes, I love this. This is the kind of stuff case studies people should be doing. This is what, our company and everybody needs. He went to the marketing people and said, you guys are crazy. Why do we not want to do this? Tell me, aren't you marketers? Don't you know this stuff? And so it got approved. And then there's been other types of angles where there's just different angles. But the idea, again, 100% is accuracy. The point often we would hire editors who wrote for, one of the big publications to actually do them. And we had one case where a very large manufacturing company called the person in the case study, looked them up, and just said, this was amazing. I love what you've done. I mean, how much of this is marketing versus real? Actually, X that to the guy. And he says, well, here's what's funny, is the marketing people didn't edit it. I edited it. They hired someone to interview and write, and then it was run by me, not by them. That turned into that CIO calling our company and saying, I want to place a $100,000. It was a little more than 100, had never had any contact, no, had no trial, anything. And he said, and if this works, you'll become $1 million customer within a year. And he did become $1 million customer, all from the honesty of that case study and being really true to that CIO who was at a university in the Bay Area.
Wow. Wow. You know, I love the stories. Now, besides budget, are there any other specific differences between, you know, marketing at a billion-dollar company versus the startups?
Well, I landed at one company. It was a data center company, and they had a really brilliant marketing guy who was a very top guy at one of those big companies. Mm-hmm. And he was brilliant, and I have huge respect for him still today. But one of the surprises when I landed is they had a $50,000 presentation done, slides, and it was 50 grand. And I'm kind of like, my God, at a startup, we would never spend more than like 4 or 5,000. Mm-hmm. But that was their agency approach. And they had the PR agency that had like 2 times a week meetings with their whole team, mm-hmm. burning up a lot of their time versus, no, I want us to meet like every 2 weeks for an hour, and I want you to be pitching and developing stuff with this time. I don't want all these meetings. And we did those two things. I found a offshore company to do the slides for a fraction of the cost, mm-hmm. had the PR firm start focusing on results. And then the results, guess what, you know, went up. And then we decided that what was unique about the data center was it was very energy efficient. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of advances that nobody else had or anything close. And so we wanted to kick off on Earth Day, the whole idea of a, you know, data center friendly, you know, energy saving, you know, breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And so all those things came together, and we went from a period of about 8 months where there was nothing happening, yeah. to getting to where we did almost 400 million. And wow. these are large deals, the data centers, right?
Yeah.
But we had inbounds, and then the big companies that were talking to us suddenly knew we had limited inventory. And so we changed the dynamic from, could you please, you know, move, could you please sign this, to, well, if you don't sign up here in the next few weeks, we may not have space for you until we buy some more territory. So that was the dynamic that we helped to change, versus they were doing a lot of emailing and cold calling to thousands and thousands of companies for data center space. And we figured out that really there were under 100 that were really in our market, and we focused on them as well. So those were the kind of changes that we made. Mm-hmm. That had a very big impact in a very short period of time.
So for those of you listening, I really just want to reiterate focus, right? What you focus on expands. You were focusing on results. You were focusing on, that is so important for anyone out there, whether you have a startup or not, to be very conscious, very intentional about where you're focusing, right? I think
that's, and I would add that, like, one of the startups, well, many of them, when I landed, they were sending out 10, 20,000, 30,000 emails to these big lists with the idea that, well, the more I send, yeah. the likely that somebody will respond. And I'd say, turn that off. Stop harassing people yeah. who you don't even know would be interested or have any benefits from what you're doing. We've got to figure out who those people are and do it professionally and personally, versus spray and pray. But that was taught, and that succeeded in the early days of Silicon Valley and the startup world. That worked. Mm-hmm. But about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, it really degraded, and it really ended up hurting your brand mm-hmm. instead of helping to harass people. And I still every now and then have somebody messaging me and calling me all the time, even though I've told them that I'm not a prospect, mm-hmm. but they're going to do it anyway. And I went through LinkedIn, found the CEO, and said, hey, they're harassing, they're killing your brand, yeah. and you need to turn this off. And I got a thank you, sorry about that. And then they stopped calling me and stuff, but they were continuing even after I said, I'm not a prospect.
Yeah.
But they were doing it anyway.
That happens a lot now, I think. Yeah. It's like there's this wall, so it feels easier than if you were to, you can't do something like that in person, right? But it's frightening how often people aren't.
There's still cold calling, but it's done much more personally and looking at this and whether the likelihood could help and whether they could fit or not and being very respectful versus that. And, you know, you might send them three or four emails over a period of about a month and a half and then a quick little message. This is why we're here. And at the end saying, well, you haven't replied. And so either you're too busy or not interested. Here's my contact. Here's where we're here to help you. And, you know, thank you. And that is what I tell a lot of clients, that please just don't go into the spray and pray. And then you don't even know who you're talking to and call and leaving a message and trying to get a 15-minute meeting. I hate that kind of stuff. And I think it really hurts your brand. And credibility is so important to startups, even more important than large companies that have established, have thousands of customers. Credibility really matters.
It really does. And, you know, I feel that there's this element of service in the way that you're speaking about it. You're really thinking about it. Could this be a good fit here? And if you, if the answer is yes, then you'd be doing a disservice and not reaching out to them.
That's right.
But it's how you do it. The respect element, I think, is really important. So you know, the way we started the call, this might be the answer to the question, but I always ask on the show, have you had a challenge or a fear that you overcame, something that the listeners can take some lesson from? So
I've had my fair share.
You have? Could you share one with you?
So about 10, 12 years ago, we lost one of our daughters.
Oh my gosh, Greg, I didn't know that.
She's 20 years old and fell. It was very difficult. I took about a month off from work and I came back and, I ran marketing team here, outbound marketing and stuff. So I had a team about four or five, this company. And one of the executives, and we're getting ready to go IPO. And, his was dating this woman that happened to work for me and wanted her to have a raise and a promotion. And so I'd come from this very difficult time, and I was still, it can take someone years to overcome, and you really never do, right? And then I'm thinking, okay, so I've had this horrific loss, someone who was very close to me. And then suddenly I've got this issue of where if I want to keep my job through the IPO, I have to do something that I don't think is good for the company or good for, you know, it's the wrong thing to do. And I basically told him that this is not going to work for me, you know, and I went into the CEO and he goes, I completely understand, but, you know, we're going to IPO and we're not going to replace this executive, you know, that kind of thing. And these are not evil people. These are highly competitive people and they want to win for their VCs and for them and for the employees, all of that. So I ended up, you know, leaving. And then to add to that, you know, I had gone home when losing my job and it was a significant amount of money that was involved. It's not like tens of thousands or anything like that. It's a higher level. And I went home to mow. I mean, mow the lawn. And I got this new lawnmower, you know, push it, you know, type of thing, because I needed something to just, you know. And I was out mowing the lawn and then the lawnmower broke on me. I couldn't even mow the lawn. So I'd had this deep personal thing, deep financial, and I had had, I lost my mother at a fairly young age, the handicapped son that I've walked over now. And I was just literally talking to the sky. And I said, what have I done this life or previous lives to produce all of these difficulties and all of this stuff? And the voice I heard back was, when you were young, you wanted wisdom. And this is how you get it.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
I'll share one that's a little less deep. I joined this company, early startup. Some executives have come from another company. They were experts in training, software training, very smart, very nice people. They had raised $4 million. I had landed and I got this marketing plan, which was between $2 and $3 million was the program. And now you know already where this is going to go from what I've told you. And I said, this is crazy. they were going to spend X on a website and they were going to run ads and all this stuff. And I said, this is insanity. This is suicide. And I got fired that day when I refused to sign that program. I just hired people in that had worked with before. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked. I'm like, and they're like, no, the VCs, and this is the agency that had done a lot of work for Apple. They know what they're doing. And I'm like, this is insane. And so I was shown the door that day. Wow. You know, goodbye. Mm-hmm. And my wife was homemaking there. We had kids. We'd come to Silicon Valley. I didn't have that many connections. So it was a little bit of a stressful thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what you're paid if you're, and I never did collect any unemployment, but if you did in Silicon Valley, it really didn't go very far. You know, it might help buy gas for your car and, you know, a few other things like that, you know. It was a real freak out. And then about 4 months later, a recruiter calls me and it's representing that CEO that had fired me and said, oh my God, this was a big disaster. We should have listened. Would you come back? And I said, well, the reason I left wasn't because I just felt it was bad. I felt like it was going to be a suicide move for you guys because you're not going to be able to raise money after going through that amount of money and having no deals, no nothing coming in. And I said, so I think you've got about 8 months left and then it's over. And that's what happened. Wow. Now, the funny thing is the VCs that had put the money in, it was their agency that they were spending the money with. And one of them did end up in prison, not for this issue, but for another one later on, because I got called to be a reference for him for another deal. And I just looked him up to see where he'd been. And that included prison.
Oh my gosh, Greg.
And I just told the guy, I said, look, I'm going to be honest about this. Mm-hmm. You know, and so when I'm on this call with him and we're talking, I said, do you remember this whole thing? And he goes, oh, Greg, yeah, I remember. I remember it quite well. Yeah. I said, well, I do too. So anyway, so those are some of them. And there are many others, but those two to me kind of, when you asked, it kind of stand out
those,
to me right
those definitely top. Are standout ones. Thank you. Now I'm going to completely change tracks for a moment. I found out that you have written a couple of fiction books, and then when we were chatting just before we recorded this, you told me how that came to be, and I find it very fascinating. Would you share with everyone?
Sure. So I was working on fall of 2003, a photo shoot. I showed you that little card guy, and something overcame me. And I just felt like this is going to be amazing. And we were really excited. And it really did was exciting. It worked out very well for our company. It was Redline. And that night I went to bed and I woke up in the middle of the night and had this amazing dream. Set back in ancient Rome, period. And I remember waking up going, wow, that's one of the most incredible dreams I've ever had in my life. Wow, this seems so real. And people, personality, and where it was, and all that stuff, which normally the kind of dreams you have is like, you know, I wore my underwear to school and type of things, right? And this one was far different. I mean, this was a battle in a particular area of Spain and got wounded and carried out. And I was this young person and the guys were cheering me on and it was wild. And that's what I thought of. And then a few weeks later, another dream and another dream and another dream. And then it was like two or three times a month where I was waking up and my poor wife was like, why are you crying? Or why are you cheering? What woke you up? And I'm saying, you aren't going to believe this, but this is what happened. And I saw Julius Caesar, or I saw Cleopatra, you know, and I'm going, you know, and it was fairly bizarre. And so after about 3 years of this, I was at a dinner with a VC type guy, and his wife was a psychologist. And I was just saying, and he had opened up about going to Burning Man. And I just said, you know what, I'm going to share something deep with you guys, because I haven't really talked about this to anybody. And I shared, here are 10 dreams, but I've got dozens and dozens of them. Yeah. And she goes, oh, I know what that is. And by the way, it's not that rare anymore and all this stuff. And he goes on and on. And so what I ended up doing is going to a therapist for 3 hours in San Jose area through this kind of take you back through time type thing with the music and everything. And then she said, the other thing you could do is just start writing these down, write your dreams down. And so what I ended up started doing, wrote them down. But then what I was doing is I tried to convert it into like a story. So there's some sci-fi with it involved, a lot of reincarnation type things and spirituality, but it's also a lot of sex and blood in it because that's what the dreams were, right? Yeah. And so I started doing that and then really started meeting people all over the world that said, I know why you did this. And including a recent customer, a client I have, that I got introduced to them, and he was a COO type up in Seattle, and he had had those dreams but never had the guts to say anything about it.
Wow.
So that's kind of how it started. And then I've really enjoyed it and met people all around the world now. Mm-hmm. And people are much more open than they were, say, in the 1980s.
Right. Oh, my goodness. See, we could spend hours and hours. Greg has the best stories. Oh, my goodness. But of course, we're at that time. We're closing up here. But if somebody wants to either check out the books or get a hold of you or learn more about what you do for startups, how can they get a hold of you, Greg?
Well, gregory.ness@yahoo.com is the easiest way. Mm-hmm. My books are on Amazon, and Antioch and Alexandria are the two books by me, Greg Ness. And then my third book hopefully will come out in about a year. I've got about 100, 120 pages in I'm working through. Mm-hmm. I do consulting for startups. I like these that generally have raised under 2 or 3 million. That's where I can really help them the great, but I've worked for larger ones too, including, you know, there are 5-year-old companies that have raised and spent 15, 20 million as well. But that's kind of what I do. And then helping the marketing teams develop and grow by reducing the amount of mistakes. I don't eliminate them, but I can reduce them a great deal and then help the growth take place without having to spend as much money, which is typically done.
Wow, that's fantastic. And listeners, we'll put the links that Gregory was talking about into the show notes, so it'll make it nice and easy for you. It's time for the final parting words of wisdom. What do you want to make sure? Like, you haven't already, right? You've given us a lot already.
Yeah.
Yeah. But is there anything else that you want to make sure that you leave people with?
I would just say, from a marketing standpoint, when you're outreaching, I think credibility is extremely important. And that's including your CEO and your other executive team. When they're out meeting with people that are prospects and potential customers, it's very important. And I've seen this where it's so tempting to exaggerate a capability for a product or et cetera, and it can be very ugly. And so make sure that everything you can do, you do. And one of my clients right now, their CEO is one of the most high integrity guys. And besides the great product, I give Lacoste a lot of credit for developing relationships with some very big companies, from a small company, because of integrity and great product that manages. And I've had other experiences where I've seen where people have exaggerated and it's blown up and their brand has been destroyed before it was ever even created.
Wow. Oh my goodness. That is very valuable. And I think anyone listening can take something away from that for sure. So Greg, thank you so much for your time and wisdom today. And if you love the show, go and share it with a friend. Thanks everyone. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you, Heather. Appreciate it.